Time to take a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor in the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Glad to have her with us, and thank you for listening in. If you have a question for Dr. Sawchuk as we move along here today, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. We'd love to hear from you, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. Welcome back.
It's nice to be here on such a beautiful day.
Yeah, on a beautiful month. April, by the way, is Prevent Lyme in Dogs Month.
It is. And I think it's a really good time of year to bring this to people's attention because, you know, getting them on a flea and tick preventative early is better than later. After you've already found that tick on them, it's probably too late. And this kind of weather like we're having today, where it's going to be up into the 60s in the Madison area, perfect weather for ticks. Remember, ticks don't die off in the winter. They just kind of hibernate under the leaf litter, and then the ground surface warms up a little bit, and they'll climb up there onto those little low branches and things and be waiting for your dog to walk by. So, you know, start tucking your pant legs in for if you're a human being, and make sure your dog's on a good flea and tick preventative.
One other thing I wanted to mention, and that was some news from Hartz.
Today, just announced today that there is a recall on a cat vitamin because it looks like it's been contaminated with a bacteria called Salmonella. And there's been no reports of any problems. They're just being very proactive about it. And there's a number of lot numbers and so on. So if you do use a cat vitamin made by the Hartz company, not a bad idea to either go on their website, or it's also located on the American Veterinary Medical Association's website, which is avma.org, and they have that listed there under their daily news stuff. So, you know,
something else.
Using that. Yep.
Yep. All right. Cheryl in Madison has a question for you, so let's go there. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi. I have a cat who has a thyroid problem, and she had hyperthyroidism, and so we had half her thyroid gland taken out, and that took care of the problem for a little while. And then she had the same thing, and the other half was taken out. And sure enough, now, several years later, she's come up with hyperthyroidism again.
Yes, yes.
And so she's taking medication for it now, but the vet said that it was possible to do radiation treatment if you wanted to. And I was just wondering about the pros and cons of doing that. And I'm just curious, how common is this? It just seems so strange that she has hyperthyroidism after she had her thyroid.
Yeah, well, it is one, it's very common. It's one of the most common aged cat diseases that we see. Cats will get benign thyroid nodules in their thyroid gland, and it is something that can affect one or both, as you found out. And you also found out that cats may not only have two thyroid glands. We will sometimes see what's called ectopic thyroid tissue, which just means little extra bits of thyroid that are there that can become active and start secreting more of the thyroid hormone. The thyroid gland is involved with maintaining the animal's metabolism. And so when we've got a nodule that's secreting thyroid hormone, their metabolism goes into overdrive. And what that will do is the classic textbook hyperthyroid cat will be probably more vocal, may sleep less and be up and wandering and yowling and keeping the owner awake at night. They may start eating more and yet continue to lose weight. And so you may see weight loss in the face of eating more food. They may develop a heart murmur and eventually develop heart disease because this poor heart just can't pump fast enough and they end up kind of burning out their heart muscle. Some cats become hypertensive with this as well. And we see other like strange behavior problems. They may stop using the litter box. I've had a couple of cats that have begun urine marking. They may just be more irritable. Lots and lots of different things. And not all cats present reading the textbook on what they should be like when they're hyperthyroid. The three different types of treatment that are involved, surgery is not done as often as it was in the past because we have other treatments, as you're finding out, an oral medication. What surgery is you go in and you remove the affected thyroid gland. Unfortunately, that there may be other small nodules that just haven't started to become active in the opposite thyroid gland. You may have this problem with ectopic thyroid tissue, as you've found out. And there's another little gland that sits near the thyroid called the parathyroid that can be affected by surgery. So we typically don't do this anymore because it's expensive and these cats are compromised health-wise. Their heart isn't good and they're usually thin and they're not good anesthetic risks. So the other methods of treatment involve using an antithyroid drug. It goes by the name of methimazole, can be given orally, and also it's available in a biogel that is crosses the skin very easily. In fact, I just had a cat in this morning that we dispensed this for the cat. It goes on, we put it on the inside of the ear, and you know, cats usually don't see the humor in being pilled a couple of times a day, and this makes it a lot easier for the owner. It can be made by formulating pharmacies, and nice way of controlling it, but you do need to use it every day, twice a day usually. Alternatively, if the cat's health can tolerate it, there is a procedure, and it's actually very easy, that's called radioactive iodine, or I-131 iodine. It's in humans, it's a simple injection, as it is in cats, but because cats are not social creatures like we are, where we deposit our waste in a toilet and flush, and they use a litter box, public health gets a little concerned about these radioactive waste products being passed in our environment. So when cats get this treatment, they need to be isolated until their radioactivity level drops down low enough to allow them to safely go home. And that can be anywhere, just usually just a few days. So it's a simple injection. They're kept in the Ritz-Carlton of the cat wards, where they just hang out and you know, live kind of in an isolated environment until the radioactivity level drops, and then they go home. And so that is something to consider. In fact, there's a commercial business now called Radio Cat. This is how common this is.
Wow.
That has chains all over the United States for just doing radioactive iodine on cats. We have an I-131 ward as well, where we just have cats in on a rotating basis to get radioactive iodine. So it, you know, it's something to consider, and it'd be something to talk to your vet about, you know, cost versus medication and handling it on a daily basis with the medication.
Are there side effects of the radiation besides the litter box thing?
Yeah, the big problem with radiation therapy is that you can't reverse it. And so if you have a cat, and here's where the dilemma is, sometimes we have these cats that are aged, and they also have, along with their thyroid problem, kidney disease. And so when you've got a heart that's pumping more blood and the blood pressure's up a little bit, guess what? The kidneys work better. And it when you start giving them, treating their hyperthyroidism, sometimes their kidney disease and the severity of it will be unmasked. So what we do before we do radioactive iodine is we see how the cat does with using the medication that you're currently using. And if the cat tolerates that well and their kidneys stay functioning fine, then they'd be a good candidate for a permanent treatment, which is radioactive iodine. Mm-hmm. It's usually $1,000 plus or minus, so it's not inexpensive. But when you add up the cost of monthly, the medication refills, the recheck blood tests, and so on, it can be quite pricey. So good luck with your cat.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling, Cheryl. Appreciate it. And Sybil and Cable is up next. Hi, Sybil.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What can we do for you?
Well, Barbara Walters just had a program on about living to be 150 and being healthy.
Okay.
How do we get our dogs to live that long?
Oh, well, you know, that's a really good question. And I think probably one of the number one things we need to do with our dogs is keep them slender. There was an excellent, excellent study done by Nestle Purina. It was called the Longevity Study in Dogs. And all they did was they took litters of dogs, and they all got adopted out and so on, but they took litters of dogs, and some of them were allowed to eat more than they needed and got a little heavy. They didn't let them get super fat like you see some of these labs that are rolling down the road, but they allowed them to be a little heavy, and then they kept others more on the normal to lean side. And guess what? Doing nothing more than that, the dogs on the lean side lived 2 years longer.
Wow.
So when you look at how long your average Labrador Retriever lives, that is a huge chunk of life. It's like 15 to 20% of their life right there, just by keeping them slender.
I have a 16-year-old Golden Retriever.
Uh-huh.
And she's our second 16-year-old.
Well, you're doing something right then. It's either you're picking the right genetic stock or you're doing something by feeding them appropriately and, you know, being very watchful for diseases, things like even dental disease.
Yeah.
Something as minor as, having teeth and periodontal disease can shorten a life expectancy because you're constantly showering the body with bacteria. So brushing the teeth is another great way to keep them healthy and happy.
One of the main problems, two of the main problems that we have right now are cataracts and hearing loss.
Yeah.
We also have a 3-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything we can do to prevent the cataracts or the hearing loss?
Well, you know, just like in humans, you know, in some breeds of dogs, we'll see cataracts as an inherited problem. If it's age-related, it's probably similar to us due to, you know, UV exposure, which is why they always recommend wearing sunglasses and things. It's a fairly common age-related problem that, you know, unless you live in a bubble, you're probably going to have the dog exposed to UV light. And although they do make doggles, which are, you know, sunglasses for dogs, not very many dogs. I don't know if they tolerate wearing them. We've had a few patients that wear them for other medical reasons, but, you know, maybe that's something you could do is get tinted goggles that are UVB protected for your other dog, and that may prevent them down the road.
That'll fly.
Yeah, I know. I know.
Thanks, Sybil. Good luck to you. Antonio in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Antonio.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you for calling.
Great. I have a Boston Terrier that was, inherited with this dog when the dog was about 3 and the dog is now 7. And her problem is she's very, very neurotic. And I'll define that as, you know, if anybody comes over, she just shakes and she's scared to get to know anybody. She urinates, wherever she wants.
Okay.
It's hard to control that. And, you know, the whole, like, shaking, and she doesn't want to know anybody but maybe one person, which is me.
Okay.
And I have some family members, and she doesn't want to play. She doesn't, you know, she's not interested in a ball or toy. She will, if I let her outside for about 30 seconds, she's scratching the door to get back in.
Okay. Yeah, you know, and if we could turn back the hands of time, I would go back to when this puppy is newly placed in the home, when it's 6 to 8 weeks of age, and at that is the point that they need to be raised in an enriched environment so that they know what toys are and they know how to play with them. I also adopted a dog that was a similar age, and it was very distressing to be able, you know, we have all these toys. She just looks at them like, I don't even know how to pick a ball up. I don't want to play with them. I don't know what to do with them. Now I've got dogs that are just the opposite, and it's hard to keep toys in the house that don't get destroyed because they're playing all the time. So you may not be able to reverse some of that. We also know that kind of the extremes of behavior, that fearfulness and shyness can be inherited. And I would love to know what mom and dad's personality were like, because if that was the case, then they probably shouldn't have been mated to be able to produce this dog. But we also know that we can make shy dogs as well by not exposing them to a wide variety of things, including places and people and other animals and so on when they're young. I adopted a dog that's, oh, now she's going to be 5 this summer. And she's kind of like what you're describing, in that she's wonderful at home and wonderful with me and wonderful with my daughter and certain people that she's got to meet. The other day, I went to take her to one of our local pet stores that allows pets, because she loves to go in the car. And I thought, this will be great. I'll take her in there. She freaked. I had to take her back. And you would think that, you know, but it was a new environment and the sounds are different. So obviously, I went about it a little too quickly. Are you going to be able to turn this dog around and have her be a quote unquote normal dog? I really don't know, but I think you need to pick your battles and be looking at what do you really want. If you want her to be comfortable with maybe one or two other people, then when you have them over for as a guest, you know, have them come in, have them not look at her, not reach for her, maybe have some of her favorite treats that she likes to eat if she's not toy motivated, like little bits of chicken, have them toss that to her. So she starts looking at these people as, wow, they're not threatening me, they're not trying to reach for me, I can do this on my own when I'm comfortable and feeling more relaxed, and it's encouraging her to be a little more outgoing with them. You may not have a dog that's going to be outgoing with every new person she meets. It's going to take time, and, you know, the urination bit, boy, I don't know if we've got enough time to get into that. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure whether it's because it's lack of housebreaking or whether she's a submissive urinator or she's urinating because she's afraid to be left alone and this is one of her ways of dealing with stress. You know, again, you may want to be looking at working with a behaviorist that can help you come up with, you know, some scenarios to help address some of these issues. And and trying to tackle them all may be impossible, but, you know, you get one under your belt and then gradually things start to get better. So
good luck. Thanks, Antonio, for calling. Appreciate it. And we'll take some more calls, but just to remind you, we are talking your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Millar. Cynthia Schuster, our on-air producer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you have a question about your pet's health, I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. Larry Mueller here with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, and let's go to Hans in Sturgeon Bay next. Hi, Hans.
Hello, Larry. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Dr. Sawchuk, thank you. Quickly, before I get to my main question, I just wanted to extend my thanks to your colleagues at the Teaching Hospital because they treated one of our labs for a mast cell tumor this past summer.
Oh, how is your dog doing?
Oh, he's doing great.
Wonderful.
We're lucky enough to catch it early, a little bit of surgery.
Wonderful.
And, he's great.
Good.
At any rate, we have another lab, a four-year-old black lab female, and her bottom fangs or incisors, I'm not sure what you call them.
Okay.
Appear to be broken off at the tips just a little bit.
Are these the canine teeth, the sharp, pointy fang teeth? Okay.
Exactly.
Okay. All right.
And our vet looked at them, and she described them as sort of being well-worn.
Okay. Can I make a guess? She loves tennis balls.
She does.
Oh.
How did
I guess, huh? Yeah.
We've actually unofficially diagnosed her as being autistic.
Okay.
She obsesses.
Oh. Yeah, yeah. When I see the lower, the canine teeth, especially the lower canines, I don't know why it's always those, but it can be all four, worn down, just like someone's taken a file and just worn them down. And especially in a Labrador Retriever, I call it tennis ball mouth, for lack of a better way of describing it. For whatever reason, people like tennis balls to give to their dogs. And as a toy, yes, it keeps them active and you can fetch it and they have those chuckers that you can throw them and, you know, they're, you know, launching things to launch tennis balls. But because they have that felt on the outside, as they roll along the dirt, they pick up gravel.
Yeah.
And then the dog picks it up in their mouth and it's like an emery board. One of the things you can do if your dog will tolerate it is switch to a rubber ball that is tennis ball size so that they still have the same kind of feel in their mouth, but it's not going to be able to pick up as much dirt and grit in that felt and hold it. And so it's, you know, if I had my you know, could even with my dog, I get free tennis balls because I have a friend that is a tennis ball, a tennis addict, and she gives me all the leftover, you know, used balls, and he likes to pop them. Okay, so they usually aren't around long enough to pick up dirt, but, you know, training dogs early on to accept other toys other than tennis balls isn't a bad idea.
Yeah, oh, thank you.
All right, thanks, Hans. Tom and Webster, it's your turn. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how's it going?
Good.
Just fine.
I have a question about my Chihuahua.
Okay.
He's just under a year old. He'll be a year in June. And the past couple months, he's been chewing on his back toenails.
Oh.
Fiercely.
Okay.
Turns them almost into, like, talons. Very sharp when he tries to crawl around on you.
Wow.
And he's getting to the point where some of them are actually getting down to the quick and they're starting to bleed.
Wow. Wow. This would be something that, you know, is it a behavior problem or is there a medical problem? And the first thing you need to do is rule out a medical problem. I just had a dog in the other day that's licking his feet and chewing his nails as well, and he happened to have a yeast nail bed infection. So we just did a little scraping. There was just a very light film of kind of a dark debris right around the nail bed and found that he had a yeast infection there. And yeast infections can be very itchy and can just trigger this dog to be, you know, they just compulsive about chewing on their feet. So I think getting into your veterinarian and having them do some impression smears of the skin between the toes, nail bed scraping to rule out whether there's a bacterial or yeast problem to start with. And then the question is, why did that start? Sometimes dogs that have allergies will chew one or all their feet, and it could be that your dog is early allergy dog and hasn't got any other symptoms. But get that ruled out first, and I think a visit to the veterinarian's in order.
All right. Thanks, Tom. Thanks for calling. And Gail in Whitehall, it's your turn now. Hi, thank you for calling.
Good morning. Good morning. I have a question about a couple of questions, actually, about a two-year-old boxer. I just returned from spending the winter in Texas, and she has a problem with kind of scooting on her hind end and kind of trying to lick back there a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But she seems very healthy and very active. I had her to two vets down there, and I suspected impacted anal glands.
Uh-huh.
The second vet did manage to clean those. And it
doesn't seem to help.
Yeah. Itchy butt, yeah. When dogs are scooting like that, it usually means that their back end is itchy. And a couple things I'd be looking at. One, yes, getting a rectal done. There's those two little nasty, you know, glands or sacs that sit on either side of the rectum that can fill up and can be a chronic problem for the dog. So sometimes just getting them emptied once may not be enough. They may be filling up again and making her uncomfortable, which may cause her to scoot. The other thing that you mentioned is you had just got back from Texas, and that's kind of the flea capital of the world. We do see a lot of dogs with fleas down there. And fleas are noted for being the intermediate host for a particular tapeworm that's quite common in dogs and cats called Dipolidium caninum. It's even got dog in the name. So if you did have a flea infestation or a flea problem while you were there, if she were to have ingested some of the fleas that were harboring this particular parasite, it can result in her having tapeworms. And tapeworms you don't find on a standard stool check when you take in a stool sample to your vet for evaluation. They come out independently. This is so gross to talk about at lunchtime, but they crawl out independently and can sit in the hair around the rectum sometimes, and it may just be that if she's having one of these segments crawling out, it's making her itchy. So you may wish to talk to your veterinarian about going through a good therapeutic deworming with something that gets tapeworms. And my favorite product to use in dogs is called Drontel Plus. It's very broad spectrum and also gets tapeworms. And it's in a tableted form, real easy to give. And sometimes a single treatment of that for tapeworms is all you need to use. Lastly, if this is a female dog, make sure you're looking at all her parts. We'll sometimes see dogs that will have vaginitis or skin infections around their vulva that will cause them to scoot as well. So make sure that is looked at, and don't just pay attention to the anal area. Have a look down there and make sure there's nothing abnormal going on. So that'd be a couple things to be looking into.
All right.
Okay, and the other question I had was, she shakes her head a lot, ears just violently, and the local vet here in Whitehall said she had some hair growing down in her ears. The two vets I went to in Texas didn't see anything there. Now, the vet in Whitehall here said he could they could remove that hair.
That's strange to have a boxer with hair in its ears.
That's
really common for poodles and schnauzers and breeds that keep growing their hair to have hairy ear canals. But for boxers, they usually have bald ear canals. The fact that she is shaking her head and has, you know, obviously her ears are bugging her and her butt. Another thing that you may want to consider, and again, this would be something to bring up with your veterinarian, is food allergies. Sometimes we will see dogs that have allergies to different ingredients in foods, and it's not the total food. It's usually a protein or carbohydrate source in the food. What I tell students is be on the lookout for ears and rears, okay? Ear and rear, you'd start thinking food. And when we have a dog that has food allergies, we put them on a hypoallergenic diet, which means a novel protein that they've never been exposed to. Typically means a diet that is a prescription or a therapeutic diet from your veterinarian. And they go on that for a couple of months. We don't even give them their heartworm preventative in a chewable form. We have to give it in a non-flavored form. They get no dog treats. They get water in that food. And we see if they get better. And that would be, you know, again, something that you may want to jump into. But having those ears looked at, swabs taken, making sure she doesn't have an ear infection is a good idea, too.
Yeah, we did have that. And she doesn't have that, but it's just very violent shaking. And that's a good point. I do feed Purina One pretty religiously.
Yeah, excellent diet. But you know what? It's got some of the ingredients that dogs can become hypersensitive to. Chicken, beef, seafood, soya, you know, just about, you know, anything that are the common ingredients, dogs can become sensitized to.
So good luck to you, Gail. And thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Mary in Oliva is next. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a pregnant female standard poodle.
Okay.
And what can I do with her regarding flea and tick preparations and HeartGuard and those kind of things?
Well, heartworm preventative is very safe for pregnant animals. It's an extremely safe drug to use. We're using it monthly. She probably should be on something.
Well, she just got wormed.
She got wormed. Okay. With heartworm preventative?
Yes.
Okay. And so they are safe for use in pregnant animals, and I would go ahead and continue to use the one that your veterinarian recommends. You know, typically it's the ivermectin products like HeartGuard or IverHeart, or Interceptor is another one that's as milbomycin. So there's several on the market, monthly products, very safe to use. When it comes to flea and tick products, different story. Frontline is probably one of the safer ones because it is not absorbed systemically. It stays on the surface of her skin and is not absorbed to start, you know, affecting her organs and so on. Some of the other ones that contain permethrin or permethrin do get absorbed, and I'd be, you know, using those with caution. Read the boxes and they'll say whether they're approved for use in pregnant animals or not. But Frontline, I would think, would be probably one of the safest ones that you could use.
All right.
Now, a problem we had with tonsillitis and looking down her throat was she had to be put on a short-term or a fast-acting anesthetic.
Okay.
The come-down after that anesthetic was about 4 hours long of thrashing and...
Wow.
I mean, it was... I was on the floor with her at the vet's for almost 4 hours, just holding her head so she wouldn't smash her head.
Well, this would be a drug that I would make sure you put a big caution on her medical record that it may not be something that you would want to use again.
That's not supposed to be that way.
Yeah, and so she may have just been one of these cases where they have an adverse reaction. You know, when I go in and I've been anesthetized a couple of times, they've got a big caution thing on me with certain drugs, don't use this because it makes me violently ill and so on. So it may be that whatever was used as the brief anesthetic that she had, you'd want to be careful with using that in the future. And there's so many different drug choices out there now and combinations that you can use that you're not, you know, limited to just using one thing.
No reason to have
to
use
that. That was not normal.
Oh, no. And I, you know, I would think that if that was the case, I would have probably given her something. I'd have to be careful. If you did this while she was pregnant, obviously I'd be very careful about what you use. But in a non-pregnant state, I'd, you know, be looking at maybe giving something that would be, you know, a sedative or something that would calm her down so that she can have a more smoother recovery.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you, Mary.
Good
Thank
luck.
You very much for calling. Appreciate it. Leisha in De Pere, it is your turn. Hi.
Hi there. How are you guys doing?
Wonderful. Thank you for calling.
Good. I have a black lab border collie mix. She is 7 years old, and she started to lose a lot of hair and have dry skin. We did about $800 worth of testing and found that we finally got an answer of follicular dysplasia.
Okay.
And when you go online and you look up information on it, there is not a lot as far as either natural things to do for your dogs. With this, she is on a variety of vitamins, and I've changed her foods out quite a bit and have her kind of on a half raw diet, half very good food, dry food diet, half because it's very expensive.
Okay.
Do you have any suggestions?
First, maybe you could talk about what is follicular.
Well, it's a change in the follicles, the hair follicles, where they just start to degenerate. And it is like there's not a whole lot that you can do to turn it around except, you know, just manage the dog. And a couple of things that I would be looking into. There's a line of products by a French company called Sauvagel. And don't ask me to spell that. Sauvagel. A-G-A-L. Sauvagel. Okay. Sauvagel. They contain a product called phytosphingosine. Say that fast a number of times. But it's a product that has been researched on human skin. And they, I found their line of products to be very helpful for dogs with primary seborrhea and other things that can affect the hair follicles and the skin chemistry. Even like allergic dogs seem to do well. And that might be something to be looking into or have your veterinarian look into to see if any of those things would be helpful. I've just been very impressed with the skin quality on these dogs with chronic skin problems where they just get managed a whole lot better. They're not going to be perfect, but there's less flakiness. They tend to be less itchy. They get better skin barriers. So something to be thinking about that way. Make sure that you've got her on a good quality level or a good level of omega-3 and omega-6 fatty acids to help support the skin as well. Good dermatologic diets will have them, diets like that have them supplemented. And there's several therapeutic diets out there that you can get either through Hill's, like DD diet, which is a dermatologic diet, that have been found to be very helpful for dogs with chronic skin problems as well.
Okay.
Okay. To look for that Sovigol, is that something that you can go right online and be able to possibly
Be able to. They are veterinary products. I have not been to their website, but okay. That would be some place to start, or have your veterinarian, you know, contact their local drug rep or whoever they order their medications through to get information for you.
Okay. Thank you very
You're
much
welcome.
For your time.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And Carolyn Trigo, I believe, is up next. So let's go there. By the way, on that last, does the hair fall out? Or?
The hair falls out, yeah. Eventually the hair become, they fall out. They end up losing some of their skin oil-producing glands, so they become flakier and drier and basically just start to become bald. There's nothing you can do to prevent it, really. Yeah.
Carolyn Trigo, your turn. Hi, Carol.
Hi. So glad to be able to connect with you folks this morning. We have a 12-year-old chocolate lab who is a female, and she has started drinking lots of water, like a gallon a day. We've been measuring it.
Okay.
And we've had her to the vet, and the vet has done all kinds of blood tests on her, and everything has come back normal.
Okay.
The only blood test that she is still recommending that we do is a thyroid blood test.
Okay.
Wondering if you have any idea why she's drinking so much water. Other than that, she seems to be okay. However, she does want to eat snow, and we've had plenty of that recently to eat.
Up
here in the Northwoods. She also tends to shiver a couple of times during the day, which makes me wonder about her temperature.
Yeah, and, you know, shivering can be not only from temperature but also pain-related. Sometimes dogs that have arthritis will get a little shaky and things, too. This is a common problem as dogs get older, and I actually have an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper, every line filled with causes of what we call PUPD, polyuria, polydipsia, dogs that are drinking more and urinating more.
Okay.
When we get a dog in that's doing this, our standard workup is to get a minimum database. And what that means is blood work, as you've had done, which includes blood cell counts. We'll also get full chemistry panel and electrolytes. Mm-hmm. And then we pair that with a urine sample. And so you mentioned blood work. I hope your veterinarian also did urinalysis.
Yes, she did.
Okay. And so what we'd be looking for is she concentrating her urine? Is she passing sugar in her urine to be diabetic? You know, do we have compromised kidney function, meaning that, you know, her urine's dilute, but, you know, and maybe her kidney values are starting to become elevated? I'd probably be looking at the protein level in her urine, maybe consider culturing her urine as well. And then depending on what you see on that, be looking at getting some of the next kind of step would be doing some endocrine testing. And thyroid conditions in dogs, typically, we don't see hyperthyroidism very often like we do in cats, which I talked about earlier in the show, which can make them drink more and urinate more. We typically see more problems with hypothyroidism, where they may not drink as, I mean, their drinking usually isn't affected by that. More common hormone problem is called hyperadrenocorticism, which is an overactive adrenal gland where they produce too much cortisol. It goes by the name of Cushing's disease, and that requires a special test to have that evaluated as well.
I think they tested for that, too.
They tested for that, too. You know, when you start getting down to some of these weird and wonderful things, you may want to be looking at gathering up all of her lab data and say, you know what, it's time to have a specialist have a look at her dog.
Okay.
And more veterinarians are going down that route of kind of focusing in one area of veterinary medicine. And this would be a case where you would have an internist have a look at your dog along with the lab work. And whenever you go in to see your veterinarian with a problem like this, try to come in with a dog with a full bladder, because we mm-hmm. like to have that urine sample come right from the dog's body rather mm-hmm. than in a jar where we can get it cultured and have a look at it. So I think that might be in order. Yeah.
I think so too, because she's an awfully precious cat.
Yeah. And, you know, and it sounds like your veterinarian's doing everything, and I'm stumped without having the lab data in front of me. And sometimes just having a second pair of eyes looking over something, not faulting your veterinarian, but I've been there where I go to the internist who I work with and say, all right, what am I doing wrong? And show them the lab work, and it's right there under my nose, and it's like, oh, wow, okay. That's why they get paid the big bucks, and I don't. So, yeah.
Right. Thanks, Carol.
Thank you very much.
All right. Appreciate your call. You can join in, by the way, if you'd like, have a question for Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890 as we talk your pet's health. Kevin in Eau Claire is up next, so let's go to Kevin. Hi, Kev.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Great, thank you for calling.
Hey, I've got a Blue Heeler lab mix. She's about 3 years old. We adopted her from Hart of Wisconsin, so she was neglected as a pup. Mm-hmm. We got her when she was fairly young. And she's been a great dog, gets along with our three-year-old. But if there's a rabbit or a squirrel in the yard, she's gone and makes no attempt to come back, even if she's lost a trail to the animal.
Oh, one of those driven dogs. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And what can I do to help you? I mean,
how do we curb this? You know, we've gotten her back every time, but when we go to pick her up, I mean, you can't discipline her because she's never going to want to come back.
Right,
so how do you do this?
Buy a fence and you put a leash on her. Sorry. I mean, this is a natural behavior for some dogs that are more like have more predation type behaviors. And they, you know, just go off and start, you know, chasing things and will continue to, you know, run and so on. And I don't have an easy solution for you. A few things you want to do: work with her to have her be able to do a sit stay and a down stay reliably. And what it's what I think Dr. McConnell calls it, the flying down stay or the flying sit stay, where they're off on a you know, run and you just signal them and they stop in their tracks. You need to have that kind of control over. And if you don't, if you can't control the dog, you need to control the environment. And that's where leash and fencing is what you're going to be looking into getting. So sorry to make it so simplistic, but you know, it comes down to training. And I don't have an easy way to stop her.
Nope. Good luck, Kevin. Thank you. Lynette and Hubertus, your turn. Hi, Lynette.
Good morning. Calling about my feral barn cats.
Mm-hmm.
I feed them whatever is on sale. I just buy the big bags, and whatever's on sale they get. And it seems like each time I switch brands, which is just about every bag,
right?
Someone out of the group has diarrhea.
Yeah.
Really bad.
Yeah.
Really bad. Should I just stick with one brand regardless of what that brand is?
Or before you run out, which is what I recommend for non-barn cats and any household pet, is if their GI tract has become accustomed to one particular formulation of food, whenever we make a change, you want to go about it slowly over several days, where you save some of the old stuff and start mixing it a little bit with the new and gradually change the percentage so that over a week to 10 days, you're into using just the new diet. And sometimes just doing that alone is enough to make, you know, the problem with GI distress not be an issue. But there are also some diets that some cats, you know, not every cat can tolerate every diet. And that's why there's so many foods out there. And there may be some that, you know, certain cats in your flock just don't do well on. And those would be ones to say, nope, don't buy that one. And, you know, you stick to, you know, a handful of other ones. But just save some of the old stuff before you start running out. Get the new bag, make the mix, you know, gradual transition, and hopefully that'll help.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I have one more question.
Mm-hmm.
Since the other person was talking about the water drinking with my dog, he's about a year and a half old, and he only drinks his water after his evening meal, and then he seems to drink almost his entire bowl. But throughout the day, when he's got plenty of opportunity, he does not seem to drink any of his water.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Do you think this is just his way of saying, well, I'm not going to be able to use the bathroom for the next few hours, so I'm not going to drink?
I don't know what it is. It could just be habit. I would recommend, I always recommend to people to feed twice a day. I just find that once a day feeding, the dog gorges on food. And so, you know, divide his food up into a couple of meals a day.
And he does. He does get it twice a day.
Okay. Okay. And he drinks only after the evening meal.
He only drinks after the evening. And then he laps up the entire bowl. But during the day and after his breakfast, he doesn't touch his water, and it's fresh water.
Yeah. No idea. I have absolutely no idea. You know, one of the things that I'd recommend you may want to consider trying just to get him, encouraging him to drink during the day, is they make those water fountains for pets where they make them for dogs too, bigger ones. One of the companies happens to be called Drinkwell, and it just has a pump in it and filters the water. Sometimes they're more attracted to flowing water. I'm not sure whether you are adding fresh water at night, and that's why he is encouraged to drink then, because you're changing it or filling up his bowl with the evening meal. I look at your behavior as well around this, and if it's a matter of, you know, maybe filling up the bowl fresh, and he likes fresh water and doesn't like stale water in the morning. I don't know. I mean, just, yeah, try. Experiment.
Experiment.
Don't have
bit.
A reason. Yeah.
Thanks, Lynette. Sarah in Twin Lakes, your turn now. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you. I have this pug who has OCLD, which I call obsessive compulsive licking disorder.
Okay.
She likes to lick everything. Now, she doesn't lick floors or the walls, but she'll lick blankets, faces, anything. Like,
yeah.
Anything. And she continuously does it. I mean, she doesn't stop. We can't get her to stop. And other than just washing everything in bitter apple, I don't know if this is a behavior issue.
Yeah.
Or if this is something I should, need to see the vet on, because it just started just a little bit ago, a couple months ago.
How old is she?
A year and a half.
And that's about
when
we start seeing.
But.
Yeah, that's when we start seeing some compulsive disorders. It's usually about a year of age, when they're like kind of teenage years. And it sounds. If, it's not associated with drooling or nausea or anything like that, it sounds like it is a behavior issue. When you say she doesn't stop, I would assume she eats and she drinks and she does other things too. She'll go out and go to the bathroom. And so you can distract her and she can, will do these other things, right?
Well, she does, but if we're laying in bed and she likes to be in the bed with us, which is fine. She's a little dog. She'll lick the blankets.
Yeah.
She'll lick the blankets, and then we'll tell her to stop licking the blankets.
Okay.
And she'll look at us, and then she'll lick the blankets and lick the blankets. And we have to tell her that about 7 times. I forcibly at times have to kind of take her and take her, because she's on a harness. I take her harness and kind of hold her head up.
Yeah.
She stops licking because she'll lick herself, or she'll lick the blankets, or she'll just lick.
Yeah, yeah. This sounds truly like a behavior problem.
Yeah.
And sometimes we have dogs that are bad enough with their compulsive disorders that they need to go on drugs like Prozac. I'm not saying that that's what you need to do, but I think what we need to do is give her some other things that we can redirect her behavior, whether it's giving her an item that she can lick. Like, I had a dog that was a compulsive licker, and we trained it to use a hockey puck, which was small, flat. The owner could carry it with them, and the dog just licked that. Didn't solve the problem, but it redirected it to one particular item, and that worked for that particular dog. But yeah, I think you're going to be looking at probably trying to figure out, get to the bottom of what's driving her to do this. And remember, the attention that you're giving her, even if it's negative, to say no, you're stopping what you're doing, reading in bed or whatever you're doing, and giving her attention, and that's not going to be very helpful. So, redirecting her to something else would be my first step, but, have her checked out to make sure that there's nothing else wrong medically. Yep, you always want to do that. Talk to the veterinarian about maybe going on a short-term round of a psychoactive drug, knowing that all the drugs that work on this particular problem, they need to be on them for at least 4 to 6 weeks to see any benefit. And then getting hooked up with a good behaviorist would be in her best interest.
Yep. And thank you very much for calling. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor in the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Looking at your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor in the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Glad to have her along. Give us a call with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Jamie in Green Bay is up next. Jamie, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a kennel of Siberian Huskies. We are competitive sled dog racing, and I have a 5-year-old male who got neutered early on this last, or not neutered, injured this last season, and so he spent the season out, and he put on a bunch of weight.
Mm-hmm.
So we are working to get that off, and we have had some success. I've gotten him down to down 3.5 pounds in the last 6 weeks or so, but I wanted to know what would be a recommended goal, like a percentage to lose per month or something along those lines.
Yeah, it's, you know, we always want to go about weight loss slowly. And, you know, I would, you know, be looking at taking the amount of weight that he needs to lose. And you want to probably be aiming at no more than like maybe 2%, 1 to 2% per month. Okay. Very low, slow weight loss. And it's, you know, it just, that's the nice thing about pets is we can be in control of what they eat.
Yeah.
And a lot of sled dog formulas tend to be rocket fuel in a bag. And I don't know if you're still staying with those particular formulas, but you may want to be looking at going to something that's a little bit lower in fat and contents that way. Staying with a higher protein seems to be better for some of these dogs to help maintain their lean body mass. You don't want to just be cutting back totally because you don't want him to lose his muscle. I assume you want him to get back into working again. So, you know, a little bit less fat is going to be appropriate, and then gradually getting back into exercise again. But it's just, that's, you know, very slow, gradual weight loss is going to be much better for him than rapid. And you're heading into summer, which I assume is kind of not heavy duty training season for your dogs. So this would be a perfect time to be doing that.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, we did stick with the rocket fuel, but I cut him down and I soak it in water, so he thinks he's full.
Okay. But remember, you may be feeding him fewer calories, but he's also losing calories in protein. So going to a therapeutic diet that is a low-fat, high-protein diet that would encourage weight loss but maintain lean body structure is going to be probably in his best interest.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Jamie. And Brian in Madison, your turn. Hi, Brian.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a black lab mix, and about 2 months ago, he started growing some lumps on his back and his hinds. Took him into the vet, and they suggested it, you know, could be sebaceous gland tumors or something like that, and so we waited for a little while. And they didn't go away and kind of more appeared, and we started to get nervous about like something like a lymphosarcoma, so they finally did, took a few lumps out last week and ruled out cancer, which is good, but said that there was a serious infection, that there was, I guess, a lot of T cells associated with that.
Huh.
And it's really unusual, the vet said, and he's not sure exactly what it is, and he left a few, they're still doing some more tests.
Okay.
And, considering that it might be an autoimmune problem or a bacterial or a fungal infection.
Okay.
And I'm just wondering if you had seen anything like that where lumps were associated with any of those three things, and trying to get more information about directions to search when, you know, with such an unusual thing.
Well, it sounds like your veterinarian's doing everything that they can and working with a good dermopathologist. And whenever we have a oddball case come back on biopsy, getting other pathologists to look at it. And in fact, our dermatology department works with another school, and they send their skin biopsies out when they've got questionable cases to somebody in a different location. And we've got great pathologists at our vet school, but skin is one of those things where it really does take someone that's well-versed in dermopathology. And so perhaps even getting a second opinion on these biopsies I'm not saying that the pathologist your veterinarian is using is bad. It's just it's one of those specialty areas that, and you can see, you know, very confusing results on biopsies. And so that would be what I would be recommending is a dermatologist to look at them. And yes, I mean, we do see sometimes dogs with ringworm can sometimes develop like more of a lump under the skin. Usually it's a single one. It's not all over. We do see skin cancer that can sometimes be, there's a type of skin cancer called cutaneous lymphoma, or mycosis fungoides is another name. Weird present, they're all over the board for presentations with that, diagnosed by biopsies. So I think think it's going to be a matter of if your dog is feeling good, saying, let's just sit back and wait until we get these biopsies back,
yeah.
And then, you know, go from there.
Okay.
But, yeah, I'm sorry I can't help
yeah.
you any more than that.
Gary.
Yeah, it is. It is. And I think it sounds like you've got a great vet who's
yeah.
doing everything they can.
Thank you.
Thank you for calling. Brent in Chippewa Falls, it's your turn. Hi, Brent.
Hi, guys. Thanks. I got a question. I've got a 14-plus-year-old German short-haired pointer, and she's been good as gold, healthy all her life. I have had two bouts of, I don't know what you would like to call it, whether it be vertigo, just plain
okay.
dizziness.
Uh-huh,
Last time it happened was this past Thursday. She got up with me about 8 p.m. in the evening, and after getting bored of begging in the kitchen while I was making dinner, mm-hmm. lay down on the rug. And when she got up and realized dinner was ready,
yeah.
She got like
fell over, dizzy. Yeah,
didn't fall over, oh. but obviously could not maintain her sense of balance. It would
okay.
be like a human describing drinking too much.
Yeah,
and
how long do these episodes last?
I'm going to say in the neighborhood of at least an hour. Usually I coax her to lay down with me because
okay,
she's
okay.
She's shaking, scared, but her hackles go up on her back.
Oh,
and you can watch her head track
okay.
like the room spinning. Her
okay.
head, she'll watch it go one way, go
yeah.
back, and
yeah.
then she goes back. And then she loses her sense of balance.
Yeah. The reason why I asked how long these episodes lasted is there's a fairly common vestibular or balance apparatus problem that can occur in old dogs. And we actually call it old dog vestibular disease. But they last for a few days. And they come and go. And it's episodes where they just lose their balance. And it's a matter of just supportive care. But in this case, I worry about other things like seizure activity, heart problems where they may not be getting enough blood to their brain. And they're having actually fainting spells type thing where they're dizzy. A brain tumor, hypoglycemia, lots of other things. Yep.
And we'll talk some more about that right after this. We're talking your pet's health now on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. My guest today, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor in the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Glad to have her along, and thank you for listening in. And certainly, if you have a question about your cat's health or your dog's health, I hope you'll join in. I know we have questions about deworming. We've got some questions about potty training. There's a Karen Terrier who dislikes the music on NPR. We can try and deal with that. And certainly we can deal with your questions as well, and I hope you'll join in. If you're in the Madison area, you can reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Anywhere else, it's toll-free at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Back after the news. Talking your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for listening in. Sandy, we had an email from someone who wondered about the difference between the 1 year and the 3 year rabies vaccine. And is it possible a 5 year vaccine will be available someday?
Oh, what a good question. And simple answer to the difference between the 1 year and the 3 year is the label. Okay. The vaccines are the same, but they label them to meet local ordinances or ordinance requirements. When you're looking at the dog vaccine, there is a very unique 1 year cat rabies vaccine on the market, though, that is a canary pox vector vaccine manufactured very differently than other vaccines that truly has a 1 year label on it. And it will probably maybe at some point get a 3 year label, but at this point they've not passed the testing. What's unique about rabies is because it's a virus that humans can get, in order to have the labeling on it, they need to be able to do what's called challenge studies, which means they take the pets that have been inoculated and they give them rabies and they see if they live. And you want to make sure that there's no breakthrough and that all the pets are maintaining good levels of immunity. So these challenge studies have been done as long as 3 years, but what manufacturer in their right mind would want to go longer and sell less vaccine? Right. So there is a study that just got started actually at the veterinary school that is looking at how long dogs maintain immunity to the rabies vaccine. And the theory is that many dogs are going to maintain it much longer than that 3 years. Could be 5 years, could be 7 years. But we have to go through, and it's all privately funded, which is, you know, the only way you can get this done because manufacturers aren't going to back this up. And so we've got a privately funded study going on. Dr. Ron Schultz is in charge of it. He's one of the immunologists there. And so we won't have any information until several years. It just got started because we have to inoculate these dogs and then challenge them down the road and see if they maintain their immunity. What's interesting that's coming out of this is that we used to only give, we still do, we only give one rabies vaccine to puppies and then inoculate them again a year later. And what we're finding is that some of these puppies that are only receiving one vaccine don't maintain good levels of immunity for that first year of their life. And we may be seeing in the near future going back to a series of two rabies vaccines early on. It's very early information that's coming out, so that may change. But, you know, we may down the road be going much longer after that initial series to like every 5 to 7 years, but not in my dog's lifetime, unfortunately. Yeah.
What about, she also wondered about the connection between rabies vaccine and autoimmune disorders like hemolytic anemia.
Yeah, anytime we put foreign material into an animal, there's the vaccine, the risk of allergic reactions and immune-mediated disease is there, although there's not been good, strong correlation. It's something that we are, you know, very suspicious of. One of the big risks with rabies vaccine in cats in particular is because the vaccine can be irritating at the injection site is a small percentage of cats, about 1 to 5 in 10,000 cats will develop a tumor at the injection site called a fibrosarcoma, which is why in cats we like this new one-year rabies vaccine, a lot less irritating. Very, you know, much lower risk. Actually, I've not seen any cats run into any troubles with it of developing irritation at the injection site. So that's my preferred vaccine for cats. But that's one thing that we know is definitely linked with rabies vaccine.
Marilyn in Montford has a question for you, Sandy. Let's go to Marilyn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. I have a one-year-old Karen Terrier, and she's always been sensitive to music. She finds it unpleasant. But what really sets her off and will send her racing around the house challenging the sound is the music and the signals that on National Public Radio, Wisconsin Public Radio, and she just hates it, and she'll bark and carry on. And how can I condition her to quit that? Because we like to have it on all day long.
Yeah.
We like you to have it on all day long.
I know. Well, you know, I think when we're wanting to get an animal used to a certain sound, like I'll just use an example of maybe a dog that's going to become a hunting dog. Taking them out and just firing a gun off over their head could be way too much for them. And so having them way at a distance and letting them hear the sound of the gunshots going off and then gradually bringing them up closer so that they're right there in the proximity of the thing making the loud noise seems to work and start young and gradually build up. And that's called, you know, you're desensitizing them to the sound by gradually exposing them to higher and higher intensity. I do the same thing with this music. So what it means is you probably won't be able to have it on very loud. You may not even be able to hear it, just down very low, and having her sitting and laying down and caking treats and doing something where she's relaxed. And then over time, and most of the stuff that I've read on desensitizing to noises requires about 50 to 80 sessions. Okay, this is not something that's going to happen in a weekend. You're looking at very gradually getting her exposed to it. And hopefully that will help. So in the meantime, you know, go out and get a, you know, a little radio with earplugs so you can listen to it all day long without your dog hearing it. And then, you know, work on, you may even want to consider making a recording of it, because if you just based it on the, you know, few seconds that they play their little introductory little tone, that may not be enough. But if you can do it for, you know, multiple sessions in a row every day by having it recorded, and then you can be in control of, you know, when you play it and the sound, the volume, you may be able to get this under control.
Mm-hmm. Good luck.
Thank you.
We are getting lots of strange questions today.
We are. And Pam and Eau Claire, I'll see what you've got for a question. Hi.
Hello. Thank you. I have two chihuahuas, The oldest is 11 months. The youngest is 7 months. And we're having difficulty with the potty training of the youngest, Olive. We've tried pretty much everything, a treat right after she goes outside, a bell on the door. She's good about going out and going to the bathroom, you know, when we know she has to go, like first thing in the morning and right before we go to bed. But if she has to go at any other time, she won't go to the door.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you know, when we look at dogs, the size of the dog in cases like this, the smaller the dog, the harder it is to housebreak them. And it's maybe because they have a higher metabolism, they have to go more frequently. We miss accidents, and so there's the odor there in the house, and then she's just like, hey, the carpet smells like a urinal, I'm going to go ahead and use it. So make sure that you're using a good enzyme cleaner to clean up any accidents that she is having in the house. And I'd go back to square one again. Number one, she's constantly on under supervision, which may mean putting a leash on her and hooking her to your belt if you're busy, or if you are cooking dinner or on the phone or doing something else. She's in her crate where she's going to be inclined to not go to the bathroom because she doesn't want to sit in it. Right. So you're always paying attention to her. Giving her a treat needs to happen as soon as her fanny's coming up off the ground. I don't know when you're rewarding her, but you need to be outside with her, rain or shine. So, make sure you get the timing down right. But it's just a matter of being consistent that way. And then if you're right with her, trying to encourage her to signal you at the door, whether it be, you know, just like, do you want to go outside? You want, you know, talking in like a happy voice where she sits at the door and wags her tail and she starts learning, wag your tail and dance around. And guess what? The door opens and you go outside. That's the same theory behind getting her to ring a bell. Is it's not, you know, it's not going to be intuitive to the dog. I ring the bell and that means, you know, the door is going to open. You need to, you know, work on chaining all those behaviors together. Bell rings, doors open, I go to the bathroom outside and I get a reward. So, and, you know, being consistent. But she's 7 months old, and for a little dog like this, I hate to say it, but it's like, that's not uncommon. So,
Okay. So it's not too late. I mean, it's not where we can't get her trained.
Not at all. Not at all. I mean, you can train an adult dog that's been, you know, at any point. It's just a matter of being consistent, not punishing her. And most of the time, if a dog has an accident in the house, stop and look at whose fault it actually is. You probably just weren't watching her. And she may have given you a signal such as maybe blinking at you or doing something minor that you're just missing. So it's a matter of her training you. And, you know, you'll eventually, you'll get this under control eventually.
Okay.
Thanks,
ma'am.
Thank
you very much.
Yeah, thank you. John in Winter, Wisconsin is up next. Hi, John.
Hi. Hi. I have a Labra pit healer.
Okay.
And she's 6 years old, and she's always been really good. But lately, she hasn't been eating.
Huh.
Well, she hardly eats at all. And it's not like her at all.
All right.
And you know, I can see her. She's getting skinnier.
Okay.
And it's never happened before. And I don't know what's wrong with her. I'm disabled and I can't really afford the vet. But I was wondering. Would it be? I thought it might be worms, but they eat a lot and get skinny.
Yeah, and usually most dogs that have parasites don't have any clinical signs. That's why parasites can survive and be passed on. If it killed all their victims, the parasites would die out too. So, you know, that's kind of an old wives' tale. So don't be thinking too much about that. Unfortunately, I think you are in a position where when you've got a problem like this with, you know, inappetence and weight loss, it's time to get her into a veterinarian. And you may want to check with, you know, call local vets. They may have some type of an assistance program locally, especially if your dog is a service dog at all. Even at the vet school, we have a program that sometimes we run out of funding, but we try to keep it going where service dogs do get reduced cost medical care. You know, I think you really do need to get your dog in to be seen. It could be something like, who knows what it could be. There's so many medical problems, but good physical exam, some blood work, a stool sample check, urinalysis, it, somehow the money's going to have to get, you know, brought into the picture, and you need to get your dog looked at.
Good luck. Thank you, John. Appreciate your call. Oh, that's always tough.
I know it is. And, you know, this is the problem is pets are, although we like to look at them as you know, as something other than what they are a luxury. And, I mean, they're family members, but they are a luxury in this day and age because healthcare expenses, I mean, it's expensive to own a pet these days.
Yep, it is. Mark in Racine is up next. Mark, hi to you.
Hi. A couple of comments. First, with regard to the guy who's the last caller.
Yeah.
At least in Racine County, it's possible to get a Racine County drug card, and actually that gives you a discount on drugs for dogs as well.
Oh, thank you very much
if you're getting it through a regular pharmacy.
Yeah.
Second thing is, I know human beings who actually have a similar problem to the cat that can't stand NPR, but
okay.
I got a notion that's a different problem. Okay, so anyhow, I've called and talked with you before, Sandy. I've got a dog who has post-traumatic stress disorder. You may recall the call. We decided that something that might help him would be getting a puppy.
Okay.
Having a peer companion and somebody who could model more hopeful behaviors for him.
Mm-hmm.
And we've done that, and that's been quite helpful. Excuse my voice change.
That's all right.
But the puppy, too, is a rescue animal and had gone through pretty severe malnutrition as a puppy.
Mm-hmm.
And his skeletal system clicks. I think he may have underdeveloped a...
It clicks?
Yeah, his
okay.
hips, and if he bounces up against you, and he certainly does, with
okay.
his ribs, you can actually feel and hear an audible click. I think
huh.
it's
huh.
I think it's probably a cartilage development problem. I was
yeah.
wondering
yeah.
if there's nutritional suggestions you have.
Get him x-rayed. I mean, I think that if you're hearing noises from
yeah.
his joints, I mean, sometimes we'll hear crepitation. Not very often. You can feel it sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
The crunching in joints when dogs are arthritic, things like hip dysplasia.
Yeah.
You may feel some popping or some changes
mm-hmm.
that way. But this sounds very odd. I mean, if you're getting audible sounds, especially like over the ribs where there isn't a true joint, I mean, in those
uh-huh,
areas,
right,
you've
right.
got bone turning into cartilage that,
mm-hmm.
you know, runs into the sternum.
Right.
There's not real good movable, you know, not like active joints like you would like your elbow or your knee. So, very strange, and I think some x-rays to see what's going on there would
okay.
be helpful.
I think with the hips, he's a border collie with a really, really narrow pelvis and
mm-hmm.
very shallow hip sockets, and I'm guessing that there it's just a case of things are going to dysplasia.
Yeah.
yeah.
But remember, young animals, there's things that can be done
okay.
surgically, and if they are seeing some evidence of degenerative changes in the joints, joint supplements may be helpful, joint diets may be helpful.
Okay.
There's several therapeutic diets on the market, and sometimes it's a matter of just for quality of life, pain management. If the dog is uncomfortable, then long-term pain management with anti-inflammatories may be necessary
mm-hmm.
as well.
Well, he doesn't seem to be in pain. He's you know, a really active guy,
mm-hmm.
but...
Yeah.
Okay, well...
All right.
Good luck. That's odd.
Yeah,
you know?
That really is odd.
Clicking joints, yeah.
Well, you know, our joints pop, you know, fingers and knees and so
yeah,
forth.
Yeah, yeah, and they can, and you can have air, you know, look at little air pockets and things moving through, and it's not necessarily, doesn't necessarily mean there's a problem, but if this dog's got a really narrow pelvis and maybe not a lot of muscling, yeah, it'd be something to be looking into.
We got an email from Sue in Madison who says, I've recently heard that onions and garlic are toxic to dogs. However, I've also seen garlic as an ingredient in homemade dog treats. Are onions and garlic toxic, and how much do they need to eat before they're harmful?
You know, it's really more of a problem for cats than it is in dogs. Dogs tolerate higher levels of it, but it just, you know, you wouldn't want them to get into the garlic patch and be chowing down on lots of garlic. A little bit, yeah, flavors the food, not a big deal. I don't know the exact toxic amount for dogs. It's a lot. For cats, it's not that much. And the problem we see with cats is that these onions and garlic can actually affect their red blood cells and cause a problem called Heinz body anemia. It causes problems with the hemoglobin in their red blood cells. And
okay.
So you've got to be very careful with having that excluded from pet food. Again, a little bit, probably, you know, if you gave a cat a little bit of garlic-flavored baby food, once in a blue moon, not a big deal, but it's when it becomes a daily event, now we've got issues. So,
Nick in Green Bay is up next. Hi, Nick.
I've got a question for you. We've got a Shih Tzu and a Black Lab, and the Shih Tzu is 13 years old, and we got the Black Lab 4 years ago, so potty train was nothing. We didn't even try a potty train, but the problem we're going to have is the Shih Tzu, is, like I say, he's 13 years old. He's getting, like, fat balls and stuff, and I don't know if he's going to be able to help me, but when we separate them, like, if we had to take the Shih Tzu away or the Black Lab away, they refuse to eat.
Okay.
Now, when we have to put him down, what do we do with the Black Lab?
Oh, this can be a real problem when you've got dogs that are raised together, and especially if the Lab has, you know, developed, is so bonded to the Shih Tzu, and we'll see dogs that they only go outside if the other dog is going out, or they only... and they only bark if the other dog's barking, and they use that dog for all their cues. We just had one of our technicians at the vet school lose a dog, and she ended up having to go out and adopt another one that is a little bit more of a, I don't want to call it an alpha dog, but a little bit more in charge and in control.
Oh, that would be a shame to have to get another Lab.
Start very gradually. What I would work on right now is, you know, starting the training process, having them eat in separate rooms, maybe just so that he learns that, you know, I can eat and the world doesn't end. What Lab doesn't want to eat? Try taking the Lab. For walks by himself, car rides by himself.
Okay.
So you're starting that separation process early on before it becomes just a, you know, cut and dry, whoop, the other dog's gone. And
hypothetically, how long should the Shih Tzu actually last? I mean, 13 seems pretty old.
Yeah, 13's getting up there. But, I mean, we see them to be, 15, 16 years of age, but usually they're pretty frail at that point.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Well, good luck.
Thanks, Nick. Thank you for calling. And Julie in Wausau, it is your turn. Hi, Julie.
Hi there. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Quick question for you. I have a large yellow Lab, and the last couple of weeks we've been noticing that he's been itching his left ear a lot, and so we looked inside, and he has really dark brown, like almost like wax or buildup. So we've been cleaning it out, and then this morning we were looking inside, and now it's making kind of a crunchy, like a noise, like there's liquid inside.
Ooh,
and we were just wondering what is going on.
I'm sounding like a broken record here today, but you need to take your dog into the veterinarian.
Okay.
This sounds like you've got a nasty ear infection going on. Remember, dogs' ear canals are shaped very differently than ours. Ours go straight in. Dogs, it's more J-shaped. And so it goes down, and then you've got this horizontal part that's across the bottom. And so things can get trapped in there.
Sure.
Initially, that black discharge could be a yeast infection. When it becomes real moist and gooey like that, I start thinking more of a bacterial infection. How do you tell the difference? You get a swab of that goo out, you make a slide, and you look under the microscope. And I don't know too many people that have that available at home. So into the vet, find out what's actually in there, and then finding the most appropriate treatment for it is going to be your best bet to get this under control. I would guess that it's not going to be just a simple matter of using a cleaner, but probably some type of a medical intervention with topical, antibiotic, antifungal. Sometimes we even have to resort to oral medications, like oral antifungal drugs, if we've got a real, you know, thickened, irritated ear.
Okay. And the causes would be?
Causes could be anything from getting something foreign body down in the ear, like some hair or a piece of grass or something, swimming and having moisture in the ear. Dogs with allergies will sometimes get some overgrowth of yeast that leads to secondary infections, and then you can get bacteria on top of it. Any number of things. Same reason, why do kids get ear infections? And why do people, there's lots and lots of reasons. So, but have the other one checked out too. My guess is that there could be something brewing down in the bottom of that one too.
Sure. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. George and Pembine, your turn. Hi, George.
Yes, good afternoon. I'll make this really quick. My vet suspected my 18-year-old beagle might have had blastomycosis.
Ooh.
And she took blood samples and had them sent in, and she said she had an agar gel test done.
Okay.
And I'm wondering... I did some reading on this on the internet. They said, I read that there's a fungal titer test that's pretty specific. Are those two the same? same or are they different?
Yeah, they are, it's a different test. The problem with doing the titer test is that you can sometimes run into problems with not getting accurate results, okay? And so when you're looking at sensitivity and specificity and getting into all that, you know, stuff, mm-hmm. You can run into troubles with not being able to get a good diagnosis. Sometimes it comes down to, you know, doing, fungal cultures, which can be dangerous with blasto because of the risk of human exposure. Then, you know, getting x-rays, actually looking for the organism on, tracheal washes and biopsies and so on is sometimes the way it's diagnosed as well.
Good luck. Thank you very much.
Not a nice disease for an 18-year-old dog to have.
No. Well, I've had...
You've had blasto, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's no fun.
It is no fun. Yeah.
Very and you've had it too, haven't you?
No, I've not had blasto. I've had giardia. But blasto is one of these things that they see a lot up north. And it's a soil-borne fungus that dogs get exposed to.
Yeah. Well, Sandy, it's always a pleasure. You'll come back in a month or so?
I will be back in a month.
Appreciate it very much. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Really happy to have her with us, and she'll be back in about a month, and we will do this all over again with her. Really appreciate her being here. Lots of great questions, and thanks for all your calls. Just to let you know what's coming up tomorrow, Jeb Barzin and Alyssa Rod of the International Crane Foundation at Baraboo will be talking with us about cranes and the annual crane count. And then after that, Jennifer Cheverini of Middleton will be talking about her latest book in her Quilting Mystery series. So all that coming up tomorrow. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store.